you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone maker. Welcome to the Crypt.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion, and as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
Now is the time for Counterspeech with Dina Sachs. Dina will guide us through the convoluted corridors of the American legal system, and she will explain how the people can reclaim their country and restore true democracy.
It's Dina Sachs, and you're listening to Counterspeech on Revolution Radio. I have a colleague friend of mine with me today, Professor Fred Galvis, and he's taken a very interesting position at Colorado State University Pueblo. So welcome, Fred.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dina. Great to see you, and I'm excited about being on the program today.
Yeah, I'm so amazed by what you're doing in Pueblo, and it just blew my mind. I read through the materials you gave me, and I especially like the welcome back Carter analogy, because you were born in Pueblo, right?
Right. I'm from Pueblo and born and raised here. I went to South High School, graduated in 79, and then I left, became a professor, but I'm so excited to be back in my hometown and working with the university here.
And for the listeners, Fred went to Harvard Law School and came out and worked as an attorney for a while, then became a law professor, and we actually met at a law professor conference like 22 years ago. Is that right? Something like that?
That's about right. Don't want to admit that it's that long ago.
So you're going to be a special assistant to the president for community engagement. So tell us what that entails over there in Pueblo, Colorado.
Well, first of all, you know, kudos to the university and President Timothy Mottet and the vision of his executive leadership team, the cabinet, all of them. And they've been doing this for a while. They have something called Vision. It's 2018 to 2028. And the whole idea there is that the university, they sometimes call it the People's University. What we need to do or we want to do is engage more with the community. So President Mottet And the university, they've been doing that. And the fact that they hired me, hired a Pueblo native, but also someone with years of experience in education, and they thought, help us, help the president with this vision so that the university can help identify acute problems in Pueblo and then strategically partner, kind of marshal the resources of a university and try and engage with the community. So instead of, you know, universities could be just where we're here, come to us, take these high level classes, and that's typically what they are. This is a much more active kind of affirmative way to take action to engage with the community. But it's also a way, and the president and the leadership team have said, we don't want to go and tell Pueblo what to do. We want to go and listen to what they identify as issues and work with them and bring our expertise to it well, and then we could try to partner and move forward.
Right. Well, what I found so amazing is while so many universities are becoming basically businesses and no more than that, your university is going kind of the opposite direction, and you guys are going to be doing so much more than universities have done traditionally, almost like a little mini government in terms of handling things that traditionally, you know, the government should handle, not that they do. But things, for example, the Boys and Girls Club. Tell us what's going to go on there at the university, because the Boys and Girls Club normally is run by who, and how is it that your university decided to incorporate some activities for youth that normally isn't part of a university?
Yeah, well, they had done this in the past and have had collaborations with the Boys and Girls Club, and Angela Giron is the director of the Boys and Girls Club, and I've reached out to her as well as other people in the university to see, can we have a community center, maybe a youth center? And of course, all of this is in the works. It has to be worked out. There's a lot of logistical issues, but the idea is maybe we get young people up here on the campus, seeing what a university is like, maybe meeting with CSU Pueblo athletes or active students so they can see themselves. You know, one of the big problems with education, I know it was this way for me, I never saw it as something that I could pursue. A lot of people in my family were just, you know, we were more working class. Pueblo traditionally has been working class. We have the steel mill here, a lot of manufacturing, hardworking people. And the idea, though, is that if we could get people to think about education and think about our university, then it's great. But we have to get them up here to the university. We have to engage with the community. And that's what the president and the leadership team have realized. And again, I'm just so happy that they said, let's do this. Let's continue to do this. And let's hire an additional person to help us with this vision. One thing I would want to say, though, just quickly, because we don't want to be seen as though we're a government or we're the city council and we're fixing potholes or doing anything like that. And I think a lot of people would shudder in horror if we said we're not a business and we don't care about that, because we obviously do. We want to increase enrollment. We want to do those sort of things. But also building a pipeline to the university means reaching out. Now, it's not only to our home or our town of Pueblo, but also to Southern Colorado and really the Southwest region that we want to engage with. So we're going to be reaching out to for instance, community colleges, not just in Pueblo, the community college, but also in Southern Colorado and then maybe in New Mexico, Arizona. There's a whole grand vision to try and engage that way and respect the people where we are in this region. So it's a way of respecting where we are.
Right. Well, it's kind of breaking down that cognitive barrier that a lot of, you know, very poor people experience in relation to a university. I know Pueblo is a pretty poor community, right? Traditionally.
Well, yeah, Pueblo, it's a very vibrant community. It's changing and growing. There are a lot of businesses coming. There are, you know, the Chamber of Commerce, PEDCO. there is work being done to try to engage the community more. We're working on our schools to make our schools better and more responsive. There are pockets and areas of Pueblo that, you know, there's, if we relate it to other cities in the state, there is probably a higher poverty rates and things of that nature. And there are challenges that we have to engage in. And it's largely, it's a, I think the latest statistic is 51.4% Latinx, Latino, Hispanic. But Pueblo is, well, it used to be called the Steel City because of the CF&I Steel Corporation. That was sort of the bedrock, and it came here early in the, you know, late 1800s, and there were a lot of immigrants. There's a lot of Italian immigrants and influence here. My mother, we grew up by Goat Hill. Goat Hill was the area where a lot of the Italians were, and they called it Goat Hill because early on the Italians would walk their goats, and it was like the old country. So there's a strong, very vibrant community, very successful community, largely, you know, Mexican immigrants as well. A lot of Spanish people, where sometimes we say, the border, we didn't cross the border crossed us, because Pueblo was right at the very northern end of Mexico. The Arkansas River, at one point was what separated, you know, the U.S. and, although we, you know, Colorado wasn't a state at the time, but that territory was split, and then Mexico was all of southern, Colorado. So there's a strong, a lot of Eastern Europeans. There's, funny, it's not a pejorative term, but there's a special term they call Bojans in Pueblo that are a lot of Eastern Europeans. And, you know, people generally get along. I mean, like in any community, there's classism and racism and those kind of challenges. But compared to other communities and other challenges that they have, I think the working class and a lot of the same kind of values growing up are where people, there's still a cohesive connection that people in Pueblo have. But we do have a lot of challenges, and that's why the university, although it's very proud to be a part of Pueblo, is saying, hey guys, we need to move forward in the 21st century and do it in very innovative and active ways. And that's what they have been doing. And like I said, I'm so happy to even be involved. So.
Yeah, so I was under the impression that Pueblo was much more Hispanic than 51%. So it's only 51% now Hispanic?
Yeah, 51%. And like I said, there's a lot, you know, I don't know the exact statistics of Italian and Eastern European. You know, there are a lot of the other groups. There are some Asian, some African American. Those are lower percentages. Mm-hmm. There's Irish, you know, a lot of the immigrant history, but they're, you know, very hardworking, very working class kind of roots here, as well as a lot of entrepreneurs and people, you know, reaching out, especially to new kinds of corporations and really being innovative. For instance, our university, it's one of the only universities in the country where we're, I think we're at 100% solar powered. So there's a big solar farm with all of these huge panels where I go run, and I'm just impressed to see right up, right where the college is, there's this huge solar farm. So it's also, you know, becoming very innovative too, and trying to be self-sustaining, in a lot of ways.
Well, that's one of the things that sort of bound us together as friends, is our running together. I remember running at these law professor conferences, and no one there ran except us, the two of us, the only runners in the whole, you know, thousands of people there or whatever. You know, your story reminds me, it triggered a memory I have of walking down Exposition Boulevard, just on the sidewalk outside of USC campus. And, we would park over at the, Museum of Flying and walk across this exposition, this busy street. And I would walk along the fence there to go to the law school, which is in the corner of campus. And this little black boy came up to me on a bicycle once. He was just riding next to me on the sidewalk. And he said, "Do you go to school there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he goes, "Oh, you know," and I said, "Do you want to go to school here?" He said, "Oh, no, ma'am. I can't go to school there." I said, "Why can't you go to school here?" He goes, "Well, That's for rich people. And I said, well, if you do really well in school and you apply, you can get scholarship. He said, what's that? I said, well, you can get money to go to school if you don't have the money. He never heard of this. And it struck me when you're talking, and the fence, the actual physical barrier was right there. And it just struck me as, you know, this USC exists in a fairly black area. And the local people, the kids, felt that it was not accessible to them. And I just, it struck me as one of those memories you never forget. His expression when I said, well, you can go to school here, he was like shocked, like I was speaking a foreign language or something. And of course, I never saw him again, so I don't know how it affected him, but it affected me to hear a child say, this is not for me, when this major university is right in his neighborhood. So I'm really glad that your university is taking steps to break down those barriers and to let people know. I mean, USC, one of the things they're known for is if you get in, if you have the credentials, the grades, whatever they like, you'd like to see people with a diversified background too. If you get in, they will assure that they will get you funding, whether it is through scholarships or through loans. That's one of USC's big deals, where they will make sure everyone who gets in gets to go to school one way or another. That memory is just so, and this was literally, oh gosh, it had to be about 87 because yeah. I graduated 89. I just remember that. So when you were talking about this, it triggered that memory of how kids don't know they can go to school. They don't know you don't have to be rich to go to school.
A lot of universities, law schools, business schools, that sort of thing, they do have these programs. They are concerned. There are scholarships. We certainly, the school here is making scholarships. There's a thing called a Colorado Promise. If you make under, your family makes under $50,000, you get scholarships. We have internships programs. Our works program tries to get employers to pay half. We pay half for an internship, give credit. So we do all of that. But it's also important to go beyond that in a sense, because if you just have a shiny brochure and you're saying you're doing all of this stuff, it's almost like saying, if we build it, they will come.
Right.
But if they don't know about it, if they can't see themselves that way, because part of overcoming obstacles, and this was true for me too, probably true for you and probably true for a lot of people that have whatever obstacles, race, class, gender, whatever it may be, you have those obstacles, but one of the biggest obstacles I think that we have is our own self-doubt, our own, like that little kid, the little clouds of inferiority that may be forming in a way that they don't even realize. The other thing to watch out for, though, and we're cognizant of this as well, because we're so proud of Pueblo and what Pueblo's about. And people did this with me, too. They would say, you know, it's great that you want to go to higher education and law school, and you're unlike your family. And they didn't realize they were insulting me, because some of the most accomplished and smartest people I know are members of my family. And because they don't have four-year degrees or law degrees or business degrees, we shouldn't be devaluing people. And we shouldn't think that the answer is for 100% of people to go to college. But we have to make it accessible for those who do want to go, who want that, so that it's a choice that we make. And that's really about, you know, at the beginning of your show, you're talking about, activating true democracy. So democracy just isn't voting or being represented. It's also participating in the community in any way that you could see fit. And I'm still very proud American. My story would not be possible even in most countries in the world where I could have done what I did. So I'm very proud of the United States and Colorado, but I want to say, yeah, let's make sure that's an option for everybody. And all these years later, there should be that same option and even more opportunities.
Right. So you said something, it reminded me of something else. When I was at the University of Washington, which is a really good college, I was telling a professor once that I wanted to go into law, and his immediate reaction was, oh yeah, you should be a paralegal. And I said, no, I meant I'd be a lawyer. But the immediate And my certain family members said the same thing. It was an immediate assumption that as a female, I would be, you know, a second tier professional, not the first tier. And my mom, thank goodness I had a mother who told me all the time, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. And, if it were not for my mom, I would probably never have thought to go to law school because she was the only one saying I could do that. And no one else said that to me. So, and it scares me because when I end up going to law school, I got a scholarship to law school and things went really well. So I had the aptitude, but I didn't know, you know, other than my mom telling me, I wouldn't have known that that's something a girl can do because everyone I knew who was a lawyer in my life was a man, and all of my relatives, my mom, my aunts, they were all homemakers. So I didn't have any role models at all growing up where women were professionals.
Yeah, and all your life, I mean, as a female, you've been bumping up against that glass ceiling and shattering it through in various aspects that you've been able to do. But you're very fortunate that you had a mom that could see that for you. So because with some kids, they don't even have that. Not that their parents think ill of them, but they don't even know what it means to go to school. The president of the university tells a story where he wanted to go to school and he wanted to talk to his mom, and his mom was embarrassed because she said, I'd like you to go to college, but how do we do that? What do we do? They didn't even know what to do. And this is where we can engage. One thing our university is doing, for instance, it's called the TRACS program. Very innovative. They started this well before I even got here. But we go into the high schools and rent a high school room. And we're there for the whole time for any student who wants to come back, needs help with applications, financial aid, anything like that. And we say any school. We'd like for you to come to our college and our university, but if you want to go to CU Boulder or USC in California, we'll still help you because we want to be as a clearinghouse there. So that's what I mean by reaching out and having your parents understand that. I'll tell you, I may have told you this story before, but my mother, when she dropped me off at college, you know, people were talking about their parents putting pressure on them and you have to do well and all those things. I went to Colorado College up in Colorado Springs, and there are a lot of kids who went to school there with a lot of parents who were lawyers and doctors already. So that had a lot of pressure. But my mom told me, and it's funny, you need to keep your glasses on for this story. But my mom said, okay, well, my advice to you is don't read too much when you're in college. And I said, why? She goes, because smart people have glasses and we can't afford glasses. And I was like, oh, okay. Well, thanks, Mom. But she wanted me. She goes, no, I want you to really do well. So just try as hard as you can. And, you know, so it's parents like that that have the love and concern for their kids and want the best for them. But they often don't know how to do that or what it means if they haven't done it themselves. And that's why the universities have to, I think, reach out and be understanding of those kids in those situations if they have the talent and the desire to pursue higher education.
Right. Well, one of the things that I think we've talked about a lot in the past and that I've researched a lot is the developmental psychology as it relates to self-perception, racism, implicit bias, and whatnot. And what a lot of people don't realize is that if those concepts of oneself are set young, it's almost impossible to change them because the human brain starts solidifying in terms of the way the neural connections, you know, they're very exuberant, especially between 13 and, say, 20. It can be as old as 25 for a boy, especially boys who are ADD. They take longer to solidify. But once those neural connections are solidified and you are officially basically have an adult brain, it's so hard to change stereotypes and associations. And a lady named Barbara Strach, I think it was, from New York Times, wrote a fabulous book called The Primal Teen, which is where I got a lot of my background. But it's amazing because those stereotypes can stick. They do stick. They will stick. And getting those kids in early into a college campus like that where they can experience other people who are aware of that and can help, you know, say something like, well, I can't be a doctor. I'm a I'm a female, you know, and starting young to get them to stop thinking like that when they can easily be redirected because the neural connections aren't solidified yet. They're very active in reconnecting until we reach the adult phase, which again, for girls, probably 18-ish in there. For boys, it can be as late as 25, depending on their brain chemistry, AD and stuff like that. But I know you and I have talked a lot about even being in the legal academy where you would assume people would be more educated and less prejudiced, but we've both faced a lot of problems there. And as a female, I can tell you they just never end. I mean, the problems that I've experienced, and I've talked to many female law professors, and we all agree the biggest obstacle that we've found is other females. And people assume, oh, it's probably the men, it's the men. It's like, actually not. They're not as bad as the females who, for whatever reason, are operating under probably a similar idea that, you know, I shouldn't get ahead, she shouldn't get ahead, you know, because we're all females. And it's something I'm going to do a whole show about down the road is how women keep other women down and how, you know, so many people blame men. And it's true, there are problems with men. Certainly when you look at like Harvey Weinstein and people like that, there are problems with men, but I think what's under-recognized is how much women hold other women down. And another thing a lot of people don't realize is Title VII does cover same-gender harassment, even if that person is not gay. They don't. It's not about sex per se, it's about treating someone differently because of their gender, and women can treat other women differently because of their gender. So I really hope to get a case one day, and if anyone out there in listener land is hearing this, I want to bring a case of female-on-female harassment in the workplace, because I know so many women who have lost their jobs or have, you know, had to walk away because of harassment by other women, not by men.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I mean, you could look at the dominant culture or the patriarchy and say, well, certainly the sexism, racism, whatever the otherness, it stems from those structures. But one of the horrors of those structures are that victims then begin to self-victimize. They begin to internalize the very thing that they're being told, or the media gets on them, or just the feelings of inferiority. So if you're feeling all this inferiority, there's self-loathing because you're constantly told you're not good enough or your otherness disqualifies you in somehow. Then when you see another person in your same situation and you think, well, they too should be held back because I'm being held back. And if you see them move ahead, there almost can be some jealousy, like, well, why are they getting ahead? I thought sexism was supposed to hold all of us down, but she must be doing something different or nefarious or whatever. And then you can, I've often heard the metaphor that it's like crabs at the bottom of the bucket. They're crawling out and they try to pull each other down.
Have you watched Crabs in a Bucket? Because I have. I grew up on the beach. And what they do is, as one starts getting over the edge, the other ones pull them down. And I don't know if they're pulling them down to try to get ahead themselves or to try to make sure they don't get out. Because everyone that gets out, there's less crabs to go on their back to get out yourself. So, and my dean said that to me once. One of the former deans at the law school where I worked for so many years said that, you know, basically it doesn't necessarily have to be male or female. If you start getting ahead and excelling in your scholarship or whatever it is, law professors are not the nicest group. I mean, there's a lot of ego involved. Most that I knew were very privileged. You and I were two of the ones who came from relatively nothing. Most professors I know came from very privileged backgrounds. Dads were doctors. Dads were lawyers. You know, they had a lot of opportunity, and there's a whole set of ego issues that go there. I mean, they have an entitlement issue where they feel like they should get that top placement for their article because they have more money or whatever, and that's not the way it works. As we know, it's mostly, you know, blind when you submit, and the best articles get in the top journals. So that can create its own set of problems as well. But I was going to ask you about this this Business Institute working with Chambers of Commerce, because for so many years I've been saying, you know, college is not for everyone. But what is for everyone is having a good job out of high school. And I've always thought, why is it that we don't have high schools like we're used to these vocational high schools, or even a program in high school. It would be so easy to create a program where the local businesses, whether it's a tire shop or a mechanic shop or a hairdresser shop or whatever it is, could get a free intern. So free help, sweeping the floors, learning the business, whatever it is, watching the mechanics, and then the student gets credit for it. So basically it's a win-win. The student gets a class credit. The business operation gets free help from a, 16 or 17-year-old student, and the student gets out, and the student has a set of skills that are marketable. And it's incomprehensible to me why we aren't doing this with our students in high school, because so many of them just aren't made to go to college. My son wasn't ready to go to college at 18. My son is now doing very well in college as an active military member, but he didn't want that. So it sounds like your university is doing something like that. And explain that more.
Yeah. College is not for everybody, but it is for some people. Sometimes it's community college or education, and sometimes it's just work. It's interesting that you mentioned this because of this apprenticeship program that we're getting involved with, but there's the District 60 and District 70, which are the school districts here in Pueblo. They're doing something where they have a future teacher internship. So what they're going to be doing, and we're going to be involved with this, is to get internships for students, high school students, and maybe even start them out their junior year. They really have an aptitude. They're doing well. They want to be teachers. We have a teacher shortage. It's like everywhere in the United States, but it's bad here. And we're thinking if we get good high school students, get them involved, they'll come back and teach. So we're giving them, they're teaching them an apprenticeship program. They'll concurrently enroll with us because it's a four-year degree. So you can have apprentices that still do four-year type of degrees. Now, there are apprentices that we can also have that will do welding. There's a big welding program at the local community college, or HVAC, or some of those types of things. It is still worthwhile. And even though we're a four-year university, from a community engagement point of view, we want to see the city do well. We want to see people graduate high school. We want to see them with good learned trades and get good jobs. And that works for everybody. The city does very well. And to those students that want to be teachers or doctors or nurses or go to business school, we have a business school, there are those pathways for the four-year degree to get there. And the apprenticeship programs are working more now to not only be like for welding and work with workers there, but also to get other jobs. We're working, for instance, with a transportation center and thinking about getting an institute here with the transportation center, where it deals with surface transportation, railway, automobiles, driverless automobiles, that sort of thing. And if we could get eventually high school internship or high school apprentices working there, then they get their civil engineering degree or other type of degree at the university, then they're productive members, and we've been involved in that. But we have an interest in getting students in the door and get their four-year degree. We have to do that. That's our bread and butter. That's how we survive. But we can't be so myopic that we pretend we exist here and this community around us and everything going on and doesn't matter. We're going to get a lot of our future students from here. We're going to live in this city where if we don't deal with crime issues or other issues, it will be bad for us.
Right. You're listening to Counter Speech on Revolution Radio, and we are 100% listener supported. So please consider giving a donation to the station. You can go to revolution.radio/donations or patreon.com/revolutionradio. There's also snail mail if you want to send a check in to Revolution Radio, made up to Terry Ackerman at 1793 North Eden Road, E-D-O-N Road, Allen, Michigan, 49227. You can also go to DonorBox, which is an international alternative to PayPal. Go to donorbox.org/revolution-radio or check out the Zazzle store, Zazzle store. I got a really cool mug last week from the Zazzle store. I meant to bring it up. I'll definitely show it next week. But anyway, yeah, so that's really interesting to me that your university is doing so much, because I think just getting those kids on campus, just having them step on campus, back to the boy in the bicycle, he never came on campus. He didn't think he was supposed to. So just breaking that one, just breaking the ice in that one regard where the kids come on to whatever program it is, anything, just to get them on campus and make them start feeling comfortable on a college campus so that the idea of going there is all of a sudden something that's accessible in their minds, you know, and comfortable. So tell us, what other, you're doing a bunch of other programs too. What are some of the other programs that you're, oh, the broadband grant. I want to talk about that because I remember talking to you off before the show. And being a little bit surprised of the lack of connectivity, the lack of internet access for some of the homes in Pueblo. And you said they had to go, the kids would have to go to McDonald's in the parking lot to get internet to do their homework, which seems just, I mean, unbelievable to me. So tell us about your broadband connectivity project.
Okay, what this is, we've applied for a $3 million grant. We should be hearing by the end of the month from the federal government. It's part of the stimulus package and everything where we can do these kind of grants. But basically, what we're trying to do with the grant is three things. The name of the grant, by the way, is called Adelante Connect. Adelante in Spanish means going forward, and it's kind of, yes, let's go forward and let's get connected. Pueblo, just like many rural areas, other towns, really throughout the United States. But in Pueblo, there's an issue of a lack of connectivity in certain neighborhoods. Now, some neighborhoods are served very well, more affluent, even middle-class ones. They have access to the internet. They have pretty fast connections. And so sometimes people from those areas are even surprised to hear about this. But we did a census research and found 19 communities that had statistics like 30% before the poverty, under the poverty line, over 80% receiving school lunches or reduced school lunches. Of those areas, 20% didn't have access to the internet or very low connectivity to the internet. Some houses, as many as 20%, don't even have a device. They don't have a computer, a laptop. Many have cell phones, but cell phones, as you know, are limited. You can't really conduct your class and look at PowerPoints and everything. So, and it's difficult. So for those, what we put together was a program. So it's very involved, but some of the things of it were, number one, to try, it's a pilot program to get some of that money to get fiber optics and other types of connectivity to shoot out in those particular identified areas of town. So we would try to get them that internet. We'd also try to get 200 households devices so that they could have it. And then one of the things, too, that people don't realize is even if they have one computer and even if they have some internet connection, if they don't have more, it's a problem. If they have three kids going to school, they only have one computer, so two of the kids can't go to school. And even if they did have three computers, the internet connectivity is so bad in their house that they couldn't be on it at the same time. So when they're going to different schools, they couldn't do that. Now, we had, you know, single moms before they'd go to work take their kids with a little Chromebook that they may have been able to get together and then say, here, you'll be in the parking lot, stay at McDonald's, here's some money for some food at lunch and do your class. And then other kids would come around that have their cell phones. And, you know, during COVID, a lot of these kids who are at risk anyway, fell back yet another year. And so it was difficult for them. So what we would try to do is do this. And then also part of the grant will go to digital literacy. So we're hiring Pueblo community agencies with people that will serve like IT so that we can teach people how to use the internet. You know, I've used this example before, but if if we say people are illiterate and they have no books, and we just build a fancy library and we have all kinds of books and nobody knows how to read or access it, then they don't have their literacy. So part of this is also understanding the digital literacy aspect. So we're going to have classes for people, as well as I'm putting together, and this is part of my law school background, but I taught a class called Computer Assisted Litigation with a friend of mine who's also from Pueblo, Tim Piganelli, and he does presentations for law firms and e-discovery. Anyway, we put this course together, but in teaching a lot of the computer software to the students, we didn't want to use valuable class time. Right. For the software. So we developed these learning modules and walking them through the software. And we're going to do the exact same thing now for internet things, how to do online banking, how to have a visit with your pediatrician or your doctor, how to register to vote, how to buy things on Amazon, just all the basic things of using the internet savvy, you know, safety and security. Don't click on certain links. Don't give people your social security number, all of those kind of things.
Yeah. Well, and that's so important too, to self-governance. I mean, people don't know how to get, you know, prepared to vote. Sometimes they don't know where to go. And we really need to have, I think, the universities and the schools provide some basic service, even like, you know, balancing your checkbook and things like that. Those are really important skills, and we don't get those skills. And something I've always thought was kind of weird was, we know so much about relationships. We know so much about what works. And for so many of us, our primary relationship really greatly affects our lives. I mean, having a good marriage versus having a bad marriage is night and day. You know, a good marriage is supportive and you get to go do your thing every day and not worry about whatever's going on at home. Bad marriages can just completely destroy your professional life and everything else. And yet we don't teach children all that we know about marriages and about relationships and what works and what doesn't work. And one of the things I read many years ago was so shocking to me that I'll never forget this. I tell everyone who will listen that if two people get married and it's the first marriage for both and they're both over 30, do you know what the success rate is? I mean, this may be a little stale, this statistic. This statistic's from like, oh gosh, probably 10 or 15 years ago. But over 30, neither's been married before, and they get married. Do you know what the rate of success in the marriage is?
60%.
Over 90%.
Over 90%. I knew it was higher than the 50% thing.
Very high. So if people wait to get married and really, you know, get settled in who they are and what they like, what they don't like, where their value system lies, then, and that's something we should be teaching these kids too, because, you know, divorces are very expensive and very disruptive. And a lot of times, I have a friend in Texas right now who's going through this, you know, that they fight over the kids. And the kids, you know, in unhealthy relationships, the kids become like pawns. And that just can destroy lives for not just a short time, not just for the divorce proceedings, but, you know, for the rest of their lives, or at least until the child's out of the house. So I wish we would get some more education in some manner for our young people to understand how to have healthy relationships so that they can prosper in their professional life and not be dragged down by, you know, the various, you know, emotional aspects of a bad relationship.
You know, I hear what you're saying, and I agree, and we could do those. One of the things we're trying to do is, like, with food and nutrition and public safety and all those things. The thing to watch out for, though, and this brings in politics, but some people already will look at universities and school systems and saying, I don't want to co-parent with the school or the education. I don't want you becoming a nanny state telling me how to live my life. These are all private things. So even though this is such good information, and, you know, you should still say, well, we're just making it possible, but we're not trying to tell people what their values are, how to live, what their beliefs should be. Education is about exposure to a lot of ideas. And one thing I really believe in, I know you too, it's big First Amendment believer. So although I sometimes will say with universities, you know, it's great, we really got to go back to our roots of being free speech places and not necessarily have these safe spaces. My law school class, you can ask former law students, would say that class was not a safe space. I was challenged. My ideas were attacked. I had to defend things. I would play the devil's advocate in some ways just to get students to push them, because that's part of critical thinking. Anyway, I think that's what law schools are and undergraduate schools are for, is a play. It's a marketplace of ideas. It just gets problematic if you just have someone that is preaching nothing but hate or violence. And I get that, you know, you can't, some things may need to be, censored, but by and large, I think we should be open, and the antidote to bad speech is good speech and more speech and letting people even air their bad ideas. That's what democracy is.
And what the Supreme Court called it, counter speech. That's why I have this name. They call it, the Supreme Court called it counter speech. You don't want to squelch speech. You want more speech. You want counter speech. So that's what we call it this. But, you know, another thing I just thought of was, as we're talking, is that for any child, they really only need one strong, supportive adult in their life, you know, in his or her life to have access to good self-esteem and all that. I remember a study came out when I think I was still in law school, and USC and University of Washington did a joint study about single moms and how, you know, damaged their kids might be. Well, it turned out the children of single moms were extraordinarily well adjusted. And they said the only group that had higher indicators for adjustment and being, you know, healthy and happy in terms of being adjusted are children of parents who never fight. So, okay, that maybe there's one or two out there. And I see I was a single mom, so I paid attention to that. And I think a lot of it is that, well, for one thing, there's no fighting in the household. I know I stayed single. I just focused on my son. He was, I think, 8 when I finally started dating my husband. But just having one person, because a lot of kids have zero in the household, especially in those poor areas. So having access to the university's programs, whether it's Girls and Boys Club or whatever it is, I saw there's a nature program also that you're looking into or looking into creating there. It could provide access to just one, you know, well-educated, well-grounded adult, and that's all a child needs. They don't need, you know, both parents to be perfect or even either parent to be perfect. That is a misconception. It's a misconception that children of broken marriages are damaged or have, you know, problems that are, you know, irreparable. That's just not true. What they do need is at least one strong parent. And, you know, back to my mom, that's all I had really in terms of someone who continuously told me I can do whatever I want. My dad was busy. He was working and he was providing for the family and, you know, working very hard with a high school degree, which isn't easy. So my mom was really left for all the caregiving. But I just, the older I get, the more I realize how much my mom defined me and mostly opened my eyes to the fact that I can do things. So I'm just really happy that there's a state-funded university doing something like that, giving kids the access to get on campus, participate in programs, learn that they fit into the university setting, that it isn't just for the elite, it isn't just for the kids with money. So what is this nature program about? I know it wasn't a very large section of your report, but I noticed that because I'm, of course, very much into nature, as you know.
Yeah. Well, this actually is a very small thing that we're working on, and this is just someone from city council that asked me maybe if I could mediate a dispute between individuals at the center. And so it really wasn't straight pushing for the center, although people on our advisory council are very interested. You know, that's a very interesting thing too. Although we do things like the broadband and education and the transportation center and high school apprenticeships and all of these things, we also want to try and not ignore, for instance, the importance of the arts or music or other aspects of Pueblo and how Pueblo has been developed. So, you know, we don't want just a bunch of strip malls here and say that's the economic development. And Pueblo has been great about retaining a lot of its character. And I think that that is really what makes it a very unique place. The thing about what we're trying to do now, though, is one of the things with the Advisory Council, and they're wonderful, you know, people from all walks of life in Pueblo that are really helping to push the agenda. But one thing we've realized, when you have that many people and all those ideas, there are so many initiatives. Any one of them on their own is a great idea. But we're sort of circling around back to get to a cohesive, what is our strategy? What are our timetables? How are we going to budget this so that we can now pull all these together, but try to do it in a way where we have sort of an interrelated, these things are interrelated instead of them being, okay, let's do this, let's do that, let's do that. There's something that I've, in working with high school kids and the street law program I did, I always used to say, to tell the kids, you can be anything you want. You just can't be everything you want today. And we need to follow that same advice, because I'm very excited. We're all excited. We're just, let's do this, let's do that. What about this? What about that? And I find myself saying, wow, we need to do the same thing here, not just try to do everything, but also sit back and pick and choose, prioritize, but come up with a strategic whole of what the university can do. Because, you know, frankly, I mean, the people have seen that we are trying to do things and then are kind of like, okay, well, the university is just going to solve every problem that everyone has. And obviously we can't do that. And although we hear all these good stories and say, well, we should do this, we should do that, and we need to be more focused in what we're doing. So we're circling back to try and do that as well.
Okay, so when I read about this Pueblo Nature and Wildlife Discovery Center, I wasn't quite, it was a small little part of your memorandum here. But what I was thinking for some reason was that, you know, students, kids are, there's such high levels of ADD and kids on the spectrum and whatnot today. And there's a lot of controversy over what's causing all that. And of course, you know, I'm involved with some groups who believe a lot of it is, just so much vaccine, as the vaccines have gone way up in the, I mean, we had like 6 doses when I was a child, and now the average child gets 70 doses, to go to public school. But, they found that nature can really help, rebalance children for whatever reason. It could be the visual aspects of nature, the tactile aspects of touching trees and whatnot, but it's really, really good, especially like if kids have gotten on drugs or something like that, to get them out into nature, which is very healing. And so with Colorado being as beautiful as it is, it would be nice if they could maybe have some kind of an event, you know, once a week or once a month to take those kids out, because some of their parents maybe don't hike or don't do anything in nature, and give them an opportunity to go out into nature. Because I know that I'm the only thing I would say I've ever been addicted to would be nature. Other than the caffeine in the morning. But it's for me, it's such a high to get into nature, you know, and to hike and to run. And, of course the endorphins kick in and all that. And that's something I think more people, more children need to get into too, is to really learn the benefits of just being out, away from structures, away from people, and with the animals.
Yeah. Part of the university, and it's interesting that you mentioned that, because you're like, we have a Southwest Studies program. We're very focused on the Southwest, people of the Southwest, the, you know, indigenous, Chicano studies. Again, there was an Italian immigrants. You know, this is a very rich and interesting area. But in addition to the people and the groups, and the history, is the land itself. And there's something about the Southwest. And we are sort of the gateway to the Southwest, in terms of Colorado, for the rest of the northern and eastern part of the United States, because it's from Colorado, then of course, you know, New Mexico and Utah and Texas and California and Arizona. So the focus and, you know, with geology and other types of things, it's very, very important. And also the sustainability with nature, respecting nature, teaching the idea with sustainability that we can be a part of nature instead of conquering nature. So when you conquer nature, we're sort of conquering ourselves. Absolutely. And maybe just that attitude of working with nature is a good thing. You know, it's interesting. Again, in trying to bring people together, and especially in these divisive times, but it's always been something I've seen, you know, maybe more right-leaning evangelicals who talk about, you know, being stewards, though, of the earth. And even from a religious point of view, it's not to conquer, but it's a gift of God that was giving. And then you can have all the way left-leaning, maybe even agnostic atheists who still can say, hey, we can find common ground in this area. We may be motivated for different political and even religious beliefs, but there's common ground in us respecting the land, respecting nature, respecting what has been given to us, whoever or whatever you say wanted to give it to us. And so it's important to try and find those areas instead of just divisiveness, and then we don't get anywhere.
I just think escapism. I mean, kids get into drugs because they want an escape from reality. And the best escape from reality is nature. And nature, you know, it changes your brain wavelength. I mean, it literally almost acts as a drug. And I would sure like to see our kids getting into nature as a drug as opposed to the street drugs, because I think it is just as powerful and just as, if not more, escapist than getting into drugs. So we have just another minute or two here. So any concluding remarks about your fabulous new job?
Well, I'm just so happy to be here. And, you know, it's funny what had you started out or you said about the Welcome Back, Kotter, which is an old 70s show about this guy who comes back, and some of the things they said about, you know, why are you coming back? And people have even asked me, you know, why are you back here? And you were a law professor and everything. And I think it is so nice to be able to come back to my community and engage and serve. So that's been really nice.
Hi, I'm Bill Johnson. Some consider my efforts to be an underground law school. I am not an attorney, and I do not give legal advice. I teach. That's lawful and legal. Consider yourself served. You are to appear Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. My forte? Foreclosure and contract law. Grab your legal pad and pen. Learn a broad spectrum of law spanning administrative, criminal, family, tort, and federal law. Fools and losers cling to old cases. I dissect and comment on the latest rulings that control the courts. Don't be a loser. And if you don't appear, you will be held in contempt.
The pill has been taken. The blinders are off. Are we in the end game? Or are we simply living a replay of a time that's already happened, with no choices? Different people have different points of view. When it comes to creation versus evolution, my point of view, we were created to evolve. The Red Pill. Every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Eastern in Studio B. www.freedomslips.com and revolution.radio. Check it out.